From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush has said he wants a radical reform of the U.S. tax code. Yesterday, a presidential advisory panel presented Treasury Secretary John Snow with its recommendations. Now the fur flies. This hour On Point, overhauling the U.S. tax code again, and what significant proposed changes would mean for you. But first today, we turn to Washington on another front. Capitol Hill was in an uproar yesterday after the minority leader, Democratic Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, forced the Senate into a rare closed session over an inquiry into whether the White House manipulated intelligence in the run-up to the Iraq War.
There's nothing more important to a Congress or a president than war. We're in a war now. 2,025 American soldiers are dead. A war costing us more than $2 billion a week. I think the American people are entitled to know how we got there. That's what this is all about.
Republicans expressed outrage at Senator Reid's surprise maneuver. Here's Senator Bill Frist talking to reporters in the corridors of the Senate yesterday.
I'll have to say, not with the previous Democratic leader or the current Democratic leader have ever I been slapped in the face with such an affront to the leadership of this grand institution. And this is a pure stunt that is being performed by Senator Reid, Senator Durbin, and their leadership.
Joining us now from Washington is Gail Shattuck. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So why so much heat over this? I mean, isn't this report from the Senate Intelligence Committee late?
Oh, it's definitely late. This was something that both Democrats and Republicans agreed to do back in 2004 when they were completing work or outlining what they were doing for investigating whether or not the intelligence was so deeply flawed. They ended up dividing that investigation into two parts, one to be released before the 2004 elections that just looked at the intelligence gathering, released a searing report showing some very strong structural flaws. But the second part, which was what did politicians do with the intelligence they had? Did they manipulate it? Did they try to intimidate analysts? That part was deferred for this phase two, which hasn't materialized. I've actually been trying to write a story on it for months, and every time I spoke with Democrats, their answer would be, this is our greatest frustration. We cannot get this report out. So their parliamentary device yesterday was really a way to force the issue onto the floor and, frankly, onto the front pages.
It's all been made more timely and relevant by the indictment late last week of the vice president's chief of staff for the CIA leak that's part of this whole great ball of wax. Why were Republicans so upset yesterday about Harry Reid forcing the Senate into this closed session?
Well, I think Senator Frist put it very well. So he was asked by a reporter, we've never seen you so angry. Why is that? And he said, well, you haven't seen me in the surgery room when something unexpected happens. You know, the Senate is a clubby place, and one of the prerogatives of the majority leader is to decide what happens on the floor of the Senate. And the fact that he wasn't consulted about it, he took very personally. It's unusual to have personal remarks exchanged like that. He went on to say that he didn't trust the Democratic leader, Harry Reid, and wouldn't for the rest of the term.
But Republicans did respond. There's been a bipartisan panel now appointed to report on the progress of the Senate Intelligence Committee report, a report on a report. Is there any news from that front yet? Who's in charge of getting this report on the politics of the intelligence out? When might it come?
Here's where it gets very interesting. Both Democrats and Republicans have agreed to report to the Senate as a whole by November 14th. This will be three Republicans, three Democrats who look at what's been done and make a joint report. But what's very interesting in talking to Democrats and Republicans about this is there is almost no overlap in their account of the facts. Democrats say there is no report. Republicans say there is, that Democrats helped write it, and it's all but completed. Now, I think the issues that would be most important to listeners would be, for example, both sides agree that there have been some quotations set up. What did the administration say? For example, the mushroom cloud comment.
Mm-hmm. Condoleezza Rice
made at the time. And what the Republicans have done is remove the names from all these comments and add comments from the Clinton administration and from members of Congress.
Yeah, let me ask you, is there any way that a Republican-controlled Congress or Senate is going to come out with a report in the teeth of upcoming midterm elections saying, yes, intelligence was manipulated for political reasons in the run-up to the war in Iraq? Is that ever going to happen?
Well, it would appear, and we really need to see what this report looks like, it would appear that they backed off the most charged part of the investigation, which was there a special group within the Pentagon headed by Douglas Feith, who has since left, that created its own intelligence, and that's what the White House listened to, kind of took what the agencies did, created its own, talked to different sets of people, and politicized it.
They backed off because they decided that wasn't true, that wasn't a fact, or they didn't want to go there?
No, they backed off, and here's what we were asking Chairman Roberts about that yesterday, and he said that once Democrats mentioned the word criminal, that there might be criminal offenses Douglas Feith and those around him, as he put it, lawyered up and made it very difficult to pursue the investigation, so they didn't. Now, if this turns out to be in the final report, I think it raises some important issues. It wouldn't be the first time that the Senate has gone after people that have lawyered up. Why back off this one? Remember that the last two big investigations, Watergate and Iran-Contra, both occurred at times when the White House and the Congress were in different hands. What makes this so difficult is that Republicans control both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And that's why Democrats say they needed to resort to this extraordinary measure to get attention and focus some light on this.
Well, lawyered up. Things getting more and more complicated there. The investigation of Patrick Fitzgerald, of course, may intersect with all this. Gail Shattuck, thanks very much for updating us today.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with us from Washington. If there ever was a Gordian knot in American politics, it is the system by which the federal government raises funds to pay for everything from the president's salary to farm subsidies and FBI badges. The U.S. tax code is a tangled swamp, and most Americans believe they pay more than their fair share. When Alexander the Great came across the original Gordian knot, he first tried to untangle it, then, frustrated, drew his sword and slashed it in two. Well, yesterday a presidential panel submitted its proposals for a simpler, fairer tax code. Former Louisiana Senator John Breaux, a Democrat and vice chairman of the presidential tax reform panel, said Americans are afraid of their own tax code, and they shouldn't be.
And I can say that if this report were enacted into law, I think that the American people would be able to view the tax system that we have in this country in a more open fashion. They would not feel threatened. They would not be confused. They would be able to move forward in understanding the fact that everyone should pay their fair share and share in the equal burdens of running our government.
The panel submitted not one but two plans. One would tinker with the current tax code. The other throws it out the window, gets rid of the income tax, and would instead levy a new tax on everything Americans buy, from chewing gum to TV sets to private planes. And guess what? The pushback has already begun from the right and left. A for effort, it's been said, but the other guy is getting off easy. We're talking this hour about tax reform, who pays what, and where it's headed. You can join the conversation. Is the U.S. tax code in need of a gut rehab? Are Americans paying too much or not enough? And would further easing taxes on the wealthy make all Americans wealthier? What would more fair in taxation look like to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Rochester, New York, is David K. Johnston. He is financial reporter for the New York Times, and his beat is the U.S. tax code. David K. Johnston, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So before we even get into the details, what's the problem that's supposed to be addressed with these recommendations?
Well, you may recall 10 years ago in the Contract with America, we were promised by Newt Gingrich that we were going to get tax simplification and a fairer, more transparent tax system. And 10 years later, we have one that is more larded than ever in American history, with favors for special groups and all sorts of odd outcomes, like raising taxes on the very sick in America. And that's what they're trying to address.
So a fairer tax code, a simpler tax code, is it possible to characterize, it's a bipartisan panel, do these proposals have a political character, David K. Johnston?
Well, they have an economic character for sure. What the proposals would do is favor and are directed towards getting Americans to borrow less and save more. And that certainly addresses a fundamental economic problem in this country where nobody, Congress, the Getty Museum in Los Angeles with its big endowment, Joe Sixpack, cannot seem to live on a budget. And by getting American – shaping the tax system to reward Americans who save in the stock market and invest in the stock market particularly, the effort here is to change our attitude towards money.
Does it look fairer to you?
Well, it has an awful lot of people who are going to be enemies of this. In my analysis of it in the New York Times today, I pointed out that if you're a stock market investor or you have many children, you're going to like this plan. On the other hand, if you invest in bonds, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a farmer, if you own an expensive home, if you live in one of the places that have high taxes, which tend to be the places with high incomes, or you're a charitable donor, a lot you're not going to like in this plan. The Wall Street Journal, in its lead editorial today, pointed out lots of opposition to this. The Tax Foundation, a group that works to lower taxes, is critical of this proposal. It, frankly, is a compromise that doesn't go very far in any one direction.
David K. Johnston, stand by. We'll come back and look at those details. We're talking about the taxes you pay and a proposed overhaul of the federal tax code. You can join us. Do we have a problem here? A tax code in need of serious rehab? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the taxes you pay and a proposed overhaul of the federal tax code. David K. Johnston is with us, financial reporter for the New York Times, author of Perfectly Legal, a book all about the U.S. tax code, who it favors and who it does not. You can join our conversation this morning. Are American taxes fair? Are they too much? Are they enough? Are you ready for higher rates for everyone except the top 1% of American earners? And what priorities do you want to see in the federal tax code? Let's listen to Connie Mack, chairman of the President's Tax Reform Advisory Panel, former Republican senator from Florida, here on the significant tax cuts that his panel has proposed for America's top earners.
Importantly, our plans lower the top marginal income tax rate on individuals and businesses. This will help to encourage economic growth and stimulate investment. The simplified income tax plan reduces the top rate from 35 to 33 for individuals and 31.5% for businesses. The growth and investment tax plan cuts the top rate to 30% for both individuals and businesses.
Former Senator Connie Mack talking yesterday about the new proposals. We'll hear in just a moment from the executive director of the President's Advisory Panel and from critics on the right and left. David K. Johnston, I'm looking here at Ryan Donmoyer's summary of this reform proposals for Bloomberg. He says that this tax code would scrap or curb many popular deductions and tax labor more heavily than investment. Can you walk us into some of the details here?
Sure. Let's imagine that you are a wage earner and you're single and you make $150,000. Right now, your top tax rate, the last dollar you earn, the government takes 28% of it. Under this proposal, the government would take 33% of it, and it would start taking that rate when you hit $100,000 of income. Now, imagine instead that you're an investor in the stock market. You sell, you're in the top bracket, you sell some stocks and make $1 million profit. Currently, you would pay a tax of $150,000. The commission is proposing that you would only pay $82,500. However, if you're the same investor and instead of the stock market, you start a business, which you then sell, or you own a farm and you sell it, or you own a Monet and you sell it, you would pay $330,000 in taxes. If you buy bonds, you would pay at the same rate as your wages, but if you got dividends from stock that you own, you would get those dividends tax-free.
So what's the rationale for favoring stocks and dividends so heavily?
Well, stocks, it is argued, are double taxed. The corporation is taxed, and then you receive a dividend, and it's taxed. There's fundamental merit to that argument, but the fact is that all the actions Congress has taken, and particularly in the last 10 years, to give favors to corporations have resulted in large numbers of companies paying much, much lower rates than the posted rates, and in some cases paying no tax at all for year after year after year.
So on income itself, you write that everyone but the top 1% of Americans would have higher tax rates.
If I
got that correct, that means everybody except the top 1% would pay more, or is it more complicated than that?
It's more complicated than that. Your circumstances would vary a great deal. If you have a large family today, say you have 10 children, you fall into the alternative minimum tax. You're not allowed to deduct those children. Even if you have two or three children, once your income gets into the mid six figures, over $150,000, you begin to lose those deductions under the tax code. If you own a home with a $1 million mortgage, mm-hmm. you're going to lose very quickly most of the tax deduction you're getting. Now, that's an upside-down subsidy. Home mortgages tend to favor high-income, well-to-do people. On the other hand,
that deduction, because they have a lot more interest to deduct.
And they have a higher tax rate. On the other hand, if you don't itemize because you have a modest income and you have a small mortgage, say $50,000, under this plan, you would get a small tax break. So there are huge changes for individuals depending on your circumstances within the code. But overall, this is not especially simplifying the tax code because it's a compromise of a whole lot of very different competing interests. This is not a white paper approach to how do we finance the federal government.
I want to come back to the mortgage deduction because a lot of people pay close attention to that. But first, you talked about people with $1 million in stock sales and people with $150,000 single-person earnings. What about people closer to the national median? What is that, $50,000 or something like that? Now, what would
Half of all taxpayers make less than $31,000, less than $600 a week, an important number to keep in mind.
Yes.
Okay. But having said that, one of the things the panel will do is eliminate the 10% tax rate on the first dollars you earn, which President Bush had enacted into law. Currently, if you're single, your first $7,300 of taxable income, and if you're married, double that, $14,600, is at a 10% rate. The panel would raise that to 15%. At the same time, it would cut the top rate on the top 1% from 35% to 33%, as you just heard Connie Mack say. And the assertion there is that this would encourage more economic activity and income taking by people at the top because they'd get 2 cents more out of each dollar.
So this is kind of trickle-down supply side. They'll pump up the economy by being more active because they're taxed less.
That's correct.
Let's turn to Jeffrey Kupfer. He's executive director of the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform. He joins us from Washington. Mr. Kupfer, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, Tom.
What's the gist of the proposals put on the table here? We hear simplify, be fair, encourage business. How do you characterize these beyond those very broad terms?
Well, I'd say all three of those are actually accurate. What the panel set out to do was to come up with options that meet those three criteria that you just described. And I believe the panel has done so. You've been talking about one of the panel's proposals. The panel actually put two proposals
yes.
on the table, and they do have some different elements, although for most people on the individual side, on the household side, the elements are very, very similar. One of the issues I'd just like to address right at the beginning mm-hmm. is this idea about the tax rate and the fact that one has eliminated a 10% tax bracket or one has lowered the top rate means that these plans fundamentally shift taxation from lower-income Americans to higher-income Americans.
Or the opposite is what's been suggested here. Are you saying that's wrong?
I'm saying that is wrong. I mean, basically, what these plans do is that they keep the current distribution of federal taxes very similar to what it is now. Now, people may disagree about whether the current distribution is right or wrong, but what the panel did was make a determination that's for political and policymakers to decide, and what the panel would do was try and keep it very similar.
But we heard Connie Mack, former senator, chairman of the panel, say in the clip we played that the plans would lower the top marginal income tax rate on individuals and business, and he was celebrating that, saying that will pump up economic activity. Are you saying he's wrong?
No. I certainly am not saying he's wrong, but there's a difference between what the rate is mm-hmm. and how much people actually pay in taxes. As we've talked about, there's mm-hmm. a lot of other things that go into what your tax bill actually is. It's the rate, and it's also what you are taxed on. So by limiting some of the special interest deductions that are out there in the code, but for instance what you've talked about on mortgage interest,
mm-hmm.
By doing that, it makes the tax base broader. It gives a bigger pool of income that's taxed, and then one is able to lower the rate but still collect the same amount of revenue.
Jeffrey Kupfer, could you describe very specifically what's proposed here for the mortgage deduction? Lots of people pay close attention to that, and I want to be sure it's understood what's on the table here.
Okay. The current law has a $1.1 million limit for mortgages that one can deduct the interest on, mm-hmm. and it is a deduction. What the panel has proposed to do is to turn that deduction into a credit. Right now, because it's a deduction and an itemized deduction, only 35% of taxpayers, though 35% of taxpayers itemize, are eligible to get that deduction.
Mm-hmm.
What the panel says is that if we're going to have some sort of benefit in the tax code for home ownership, it should be available to everyone. And so we turn that into a credit that's available to all taxpayers, and we set it at a 15% rate. So every American who has mortgage interest will be able to take a credit of 15% of that interest.
But you would also cap the amount of interest that a taxpayer could deduct or claim or get credit for. Is that right?
That's correct. What the panel determined is that a provision like this should be designed to encourage home ownership, not necessarily just to encourage larger homes. And so the panel looked around the country and wanted to take a limit that was the average home price in different areas around the country. And so what the panel did was settle on a limit that ranges from approximately $220,000 in certain areas of the country to up to $412,000 in other areas of the country.
Depending on the local house price of housing, and that as opposed to the current, what is it, $1.2 million that people can deduct on?
It's $1.1 million, and that's a rate that applies everywhere in the country.
The National Association of Realtors saying in a statement this would drive down real estate values, have a devastating effect on the nation's housing economy. What do you say to that?
Well, in 2004, when one looks at the number of mortgages, at the mortgages that were originated for that year, between 85 and 90% of all the mortgages that were originated in 2004 are actually below the caps that the panel has proposed. So we're only talking about a small percentage of mortgages that are above that cap. And this proposal spreads out those benefits so it's more evenly distributed among all homeowners, not just the high end.
Let me bring in another voice from Washington, if I may. Bob McIntyre joins us. He's director of Citizens for Tax Justice, a contributing editor at the American Prospect magazine, kind of liberal view of the world. Bob McIntyre, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What do you make of the proposals put on the table yesterday? We hear that President Bush may put a big push or effort in tax reform next year, may bring it prominently up in his State of the Union address. What do you see brewing in these proposals, Bob?
Well, I think you need to look at the big picture first, and then the details are interesting.
Okay, yep.
But if you looked at the current system, you'd say, well, what's wrong? And number one, the current tax system doesn't raise nearly enough money to pay for the government, so we run these gigantic budget deficits.
We did notice those, yeah.
And secondly, it favors income from capital over wages so much that wages are taxed now at more than double the rate that capital income is subject to. So what does the panel do about these two problems? It makes both of them much worse. On the deficit side, it plans apparently to borrow another $7 trillion over the next 20 years to pay for this plan.
It doesn't step up to the red ink that's out there, you're saying. It doesn't address
worse
that.
Than that. It adds $7 trillion to
mm-hmm.
our budget deficits.
Mm-hmm.
And as for capital versus wages, this makes the tax burden more tilted towards taxing wage earners, middle-income people, and less towards taxing investors, which are generally upper-income people.
Jeffrey Kupfer was saying they tried to keep the sort of spread of the burden more or less comparable to where it is now. You don't see that?
Well, it's that's just not true. It's possibly true in the very short run, but by the time this plan gets fully implemented, say when that mortgage provision you talked about is fully in place, but that's not the reason why, this plan, because it costs so much and because it's the cost of it and the tax cuts that it envisions are so tilted towards the upper end of the income scale, this makes the tax system much less progressive than it is now.
We heard Connie Mack celebrating that in some degree, saying this is going to encourage, stimulate the economy, stimulate investment, be good for all Americans.
Well, you know, we heard George Bush tell us back in the campaign of 2000 that we could balance the budget, save Social Security, and cut the taxes, and everything would work out, and that was false. So we've tried this before. The trickle-down didn't work, and we certainly didn't solve the budget deficit problem. We went from a big surplus to gigantic deficits with no hope to deal with them unless we start fixing the tax system so that those with the most money start paying taxes again.
We've got a lot of taxpayers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Juan is calling from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
Hi.
All right. What do you think, Juan?
Of the two options, the first one, I've heard a lot, but I haven't digested it yet. But the second one, of taxation of everything we purchase, that has been tried in other countries, and it clearly taxes lower earners more than higher earners because of the fact that lower earners usually spend all their money purchasing goods.
Things that they need for groceries and gas and the rest.
Exactly. And higher earners tend to spend up to a certain amount and save the rest.
So you're wary of that one. Let us turn and get some of those details, Juan. Thanks for your call. Jeffrey Kupfer, how about the proposal of, is it called a value-added tax here, a kind of national sales tax? Is that what we're talking about?
No. In fact, the panel considered both a national retail sales tax and a value-added tax and decided not to recommend either one of those proposals. And so what the panel has done, both of its proposals work within the current tax system. So
we've got it wrong. That's not on the table at all. We're not looking at any proposal here to move away from income tax?
Both of our proposals work within the current system. They do change how some of the calculations are made within the current system, but we do not fundamentally scrap the current system and move to some sort of sales tax or something else that I think the caller was referring to.
Well, my apologies for that. David K. Johnston, we're still within an income tax kind of paradigm here that Americans would understand, be familiar with.
Yes, the second proposal is designed, and I think I'm almost exactly quoting from the Commission's almost 300-page report, to move us closer to eliminating taxes on what it refers to, I think, as entrepreneurial and business activity, but essentially on capital. You know, you often hear President Bush say you should only be taxed once on a dollar, and he's talking there about capital incomes, not wage incomes. And this is an issue we need to have a serious debate about. I mean, do we want to have a society, and will we be better off if we decide to shift to a system in which once you've saved a dollar, all the income that ever flows from that to you, and if we were to repeal the estate tax to your heirs forever, will be outside of the tax system? And what kind of a system will we get? How much more saving? And after all, without saving an investment, we can't have high-value jobs because they require investment.
Right.
But what happens if we go in that direction?
Bob McIntyre, what about it? You see this pushing in that direction, but you don't see that as a good way to go.
Well, no. It obviously is pushing in that direction. That's what they want to do. That's what they've been doing, the Bush administration, since it came into office, is to try to lower taxes on capital and shift the burden onto wages, and this moves it more in that direction. Now, is that a good idea? Well, it's certainly a theory you can have. Ronald Reagan had that theory for a while, discovered it was a disaster, rejected it, and in 1986 went to a real tax reform program that taxed all income, whether it was dividends or capital gains or wages or whatever, at the same rates, same progressive rates. And that system worked out well. The economy picked up after 1986, after the 86 reforms, and did very well. Then, as you know, in 1993, Bill Clinton, faced with the remnants of the first Bush recession, raised the tax rates on the top earners, and the economy boomed again. So it just sort of looks like cutting taxes for the rich is not the panacea that some people on the right think. To the contrary, getting the government's books back in order, treating different kinds of income the same so that the government gets out of the way and lets private markets determine where investment goes, that's a better system for our country. And that's where we should be heading, not where this panel's report is trying to send us.
Jeffrey Kupfer, we've just got you for half a minute. Will you fly to the defense of the supply side vision, I guess, is embedded here?
Well, I'd like to make two points. One is that the panel did work within the framework of revenue neutrality, which meant that what we were trying to do was basically to collect the same amount of money as the system is currently projected.
Which leaves the deficit there. But what about the tilt toward capital?
Well, from the standpoint of trying to ensure that money is only taxed once, I think that's something the panel was certainly looking to do. It's important that we do have savings and investment in this country. The current tax system has a bias against that. In fact, it penalizes savings and investment. And what the panel was trying to do was to at least make it neutral among that, so that when a dollar is the decision about whether to save a dollar or whether to spend a dollar.
It's made once, and we've got it. Jeffrey Kupfer, Executive Director of the President's Panel, thanks very much for being with us. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the taxes you pay, the taxes you may pay in the future. Overhaul is in the wind. President Bush could make a big push on it with his State of the Union speech, we're told, coming up early next year. A new presidential panel has submitted its proposals for where the federal tax code ought to go. Yesterday, Treasury Secretary John Snow said some people may find the panel's suggestions hard to swallow. But he said America needs big, bold thinking about a new set of tax reforms.
These are recommendations that will challenge orthodoxy in a lot of ways on tax policy. That's what the president asked the panel to do, to come up with a bold, far-reaching set of recommendations to accomplish the broad objectives of greater fairness, less complexity, and make it more growth-oriented so America continues to be an economy that grows and expands and is competitive as we can be and attracts capital. That's a big task.
A big task indeed. Treasury Secretary John Snow yesterday. You can join the conversation should stock dividends and those who get them be advantaged, further advantaged in the tax code. Who wins and who loses in the tax overhaul game? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been talking with David K. Johnston, financial reporter for the New York Times who covers the U.S. taxation. Bob McIntyre is with us, director of Citizens for Tax Justice. And right now from Washington, Stephen Enten joins us, president of the Institute for Research on the Economics of Taxation. He was deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the Reagan administration. A more conservative view of what's going on, what's being proposed. Stephen Enten, thanks for being with us. What do you make of the proposals?
Thanks for having me, Tom. The proposals are something of a mixed bag. They do a great deal to simplify the code. I think there's no question about that. They offer two streamlined plans, one which goes further in, I would say, promoting or trying to promote saving and growth than the other. They raise a number of important points that we need to address, and they give a fairly clear description of some of the problems in the current tax system. I think that they did try to address the distribution issues very carefully. If you look at the tables and materials, you'll find that in almost every income category, the share of the tax burden is maintained, possibly a little higher at the top, actually. But what they have tried to do is to make additional saving and additional investment more attractive by taking away some of the deductions that we have in the current code, so that we can get some more growth going.
David K. Johnston was pointing out that seems to be very much tilted towards stock investment rather than, let's say, in business or entrepreneurial arena or farms, for that matter. Do you think that's the right emphasis?
I think it's a bit of mischaracterization. You have to realize where we start. As David mentioned, there is a definite double taxation of the corporate earnings stream. If I'm a saver and I put my money into a corporation, it's going to be taxed twice. If I put it into a bond, it's going to be taxed to me only with the one time. That bias has tilted us in favor of debt investment rather than equity investment, and some firms in recessions find they can't meet their debt obligations. It's inherently riskier. We may be over-leveraged. And the higher tax rate on equities does indeed reduce total investment. One of the reasons for that is that when firms have borrowed as much as they can tolerate,
yep,
they have to raise their new investment money in the equity market. And if you have these double taxes in that area, it drives up the cost of plant and equipment, reduces the number of factories and the modernization programs, and we end up with lower wages and lower productivity and fewer jobs.
But if this went through, what? We'd see a bump up in the stock market, and you would say better wages and more jobs.
Yes, I think the evidence is that in the general drift toward a tax system with multiple layers of tax on capital to one with a single layer of tax, you find you get more growth, more investment, and higher wages. There have been several studies out which suggest that in this shift over toward what's called a consumed income tax, you could get several percent more growth, maybe 7, 9, or even 11% more growth in the GDP, and that workers would, in fact, be better off under such a system where capital was taxed once rather than several times. So the plans are doing, in simplification and in I guess what they would call efficiency, they're trying to take all of the taxes on all types of investment from all types of businesses and put them on a more even footing instead of taxing sometimes more than others, and instead of taxing saving and investment more heavily than consumption.
Yeah. David K. Johnston, we heard Bob McIntyre say he does not share the view of the impact of that kind of drift. What about it? The double taxation charge and complaint has been out there for a long time. Steve Enten says, look, let's go this way and we'll have higher wages and, everybody will be better off.
Well, classic economic theory certainly does say essentially what Steve has laid out, that the double taxation has an effect. But, as with all things in tax, it is incredibly more complicated than we're ever going to be able to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
There are deferral regimes. There are questions about how we measure capital. If you're the manager of a corporation, the more you leverage your company with debt rather than equity, the lower the return you have to earn in order for the company to do well, and you, therefore, as the manager, have a different interest than the shareholders do in the the financial structure of that company.
Right.
But fundamentally, the commission is trying to address this issue that we keep borrowing, that is, we keep taking the future into the present and paying interest on it,
mm-hmm.
rather than building up assets. And then when you get to the asset side of that, the problem is that assets are incredibly narrowly held in this country. In the last year the government released this data, we know that 7% of all the capital gains in America went to 400 people, that half the capital gains in America go to something like 0.7% of people in America. I mean, it's incredibly narrow. And once you get out of the upper reaches, stock ownership, it's just very narrow in this country.
So it would sound on the face of it as though these proposals would tilt even further in that direction, unless I
Well, they may. And then there's a second larger issue, Tom, and that is we live in this world now that capital, services, and goods move across borders freely and labor does not. And that creates an arbitrage situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also part of this that has to be addressed, that we don't live in the world our tax system was designed for. That was a national industrial wage economy. We live in a global services asset world.
Which works for capital but against labor's leverage, you're saying.
Well, works for labor if you're in one of the places that didn't have jobs and now does. But it certainly works against
If you're in India, true.
If you're in the United States, mm-hmm. works against you.
Mm-hmm. Sue's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, I am appalled at the thought that we're going to raise taxes on the poorer section of the country and lower my taxes. I want my taxes raised. I really believe that until people can feed their families and have a home and daycare and health care, we simply should not lower anybody's taxes except the poor.
So you feel fairly well off and you're saying, hit me
yes.
again. I want to benefit the...
And, I mean, it took us a while to reach this, but we're fine. And giving to charity is not enough. We need to somehow redistribute our money so that we can pay off debts. I mean, I don't think Mr. Bush has ever done a household budget in his life, and help the poor.
And you're not hearing it right here, Bob McIntyre. What do you say to Sue?
Well, I'll say that this plan makes it much harder for the government to help the poor than it even is now, because you heard the director of the panel, the executive director, say that the plan was revenue neutral. Well, let me tell you what he meant by that. He meant revenue neutral if Bush's tax cuts are extended forever. They expire in 2010 under current law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the current Congress, a very conservative Congress, hasn't found the money to extend Bush's tax cuts, and yet this panel, almost in a footnote, says, and we're going to spend $7 trillion over 20 years to pay for this program. Well, where do you think that money's going to come from? We can see it now when Congress is cutting programs for low-income people, or it's going to come in higher taxes on our children. Either way, this is just so irresponsible. If they're worried about savings, get the government to stop borrowing so much. If they're worried about double taxation, by the way, the only thing that's really double taxed right now are wages. You pay both income and payroll tax on it. Income from capital, the corporations, half of them don't pay any taxes, and the people who receive capital income, half of them don't pay any taxes. So there's no double tax now, and they're addressing a non-problem. And stop crying about that. If you're worried about double taxes, think about wages.
We have seen many businesses paying less or no tax in recent years. I've seen those numbers. Michael's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. In Iowa, we have a great life, you should know. And everybody who in Iowa who is sensible knows that they have to pay for the great life that we currently have. But there is a difference between simplification processes and fairness processes. If we're going to talk about fairness, let's ask the guests if in this plan there's anything about corporations who are having offshore headquarters to avoid paying for their piece of the great life that I'm describing. Is there anything in there that says you don't get to have the same benefits if you don't, if you put your corporation somewhere so that they do not have to pay taxes to this country?
A fair question, and one David K. Johnston has written a lot about. Michael, thanks for raising it. David, what about it? You've written a lot about shelters. Do you see shelters being deconstructed in this plan?
Not really. I mean, we actually have evidence from Florida where there's a tax of $1 million. It's $1,000 on $1 million. That people will go to some substantial extremes to avoid that. So lowering rates reduces some tax avoidance behavior, but not a lot of it. Interestingly, you know, Congress, out of my book, Perfectly Legal, there were five laws passed out based on outrages I pointed out. One of them was a complete fraud. Congress passed a law saying that if you expatriate, you rent a mailbox in Bermuda to avoid U.S. corporate taxes,
right,
you can't have a contract with the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
Asterisk, your American subsidiary can.
Ah. Oh. So there's still a way around it.
Absolutely.
But in the simplification here, are those, for example, offshore advantages taken away? Is the asterisk gone here, or do we know? Does it get that detailed?
I have not read the report with enough care to say absolutely, but I did not catch anything that would take away the ability to do those kinds of things. And we're going to see more and more of this. We've seen in 1990 about 1% of U.S. corporate profits were taken in tax havens like the Cayman Islands. By 2003, it was up to 17% and growing rapidly. Corporations, the tax code is telling corporations, move your intellectual property, move your assets outside the U.S. We actually have a couple of major U.S. corporations that have a negative net worth in the United States.
And Michael, our caller, says if you want to enjoy the great life in Iowa, in this country, if you can get it, help pay for it. Brian's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Well.
I'm a city councilor in Cambridge, and I can tell you on behalf of the National League of Cities that this is something that's going to be outrageous for municipalities, because for all the discussion about double taxation, it's essentially going to put in place double taxation for local taxpayers, because under this proposal, you'd no longer be able to deduct your local taxes, whether they be property, income, or sales tax.
Or state tax, for that matter, as I
exactly.
understand.
Exactly. And so middle-class taxpayers are going to find themselves paying a tax on a tax in this instance that they haven't before. And it's unfortunate that we're going to be looking to eliminate the alternative minimum tax instead of simply reforming it so that the wealthiest of taxpayers will avoid paying income tax altogether, and instead cities and their residents are going to be paying more the burden.
So if you're in a state or a community where taxes are relatively high, you're going to lose that deduction, and it's tougher on you. Stephen Enten, what about that? Is that a kind of equivalent of the double hit, as our city councilor suggests?
Well, I've been hearing a number of things that are a little bit off in the discussion. I kind of feel like a mosquito in a nudist colony. You don't know where to start.
Just dive in.
Allow the deduction for the state and local taxes either. You're basically swapping one thing off for another there. That's not going to be a key distinction. I personally don't favor eliminating that deduction because you shouldn't be taxing a tax. The reason it was put in fact, was to keep the income distribution such of the tax such that the upper income would continue to pay, or the upper middle income. So the people who are kind of tending to say it's too tilted toward the upper income are then complaining about one of the things that takes away from the middle and upper income. It's kind of a mixed kind of assault on the plan. Getting back to Sue for a minute, she was worried about raising taxes on the lower income. The new family credit and the new work credit, it seems to me, take a number of low-income people off the tax rolls. I think there's a reduction at that end of it. I think we need to read the plan carefully. One of the problems is it's 300 pages long, and people haven't had the time to go through it in detail. Something was also said earlier about whether we're eliminating taxation of capital and businesses aren't paying tax on their income. There are many companies with revenues that have losses and don't pay tax, but you're not finding companies that actually have income that aren't paying tax.
Of course, part of it is where that income is claimed, isn't it?
Yes, where it's claimed, but also whether it's measured properly. And what part of this report goes into is that the current accounting rules in the code very often overstate income and end up imposing what is, in effect, double taxation, where if you measure the income properly, they would, in fact, not owe. And so you're going to see some correction of that, and it was deliberate because when you overstate the firm's income, the statutory rates go way, the effective rates go way above the statutory rates, and investment is discouraged. It's a fact of life, whether we like it or not, that people can always choose to consume instead of save. And if they find that the saving is taxed more heavily than the income they use for consumption, it does significantly affect behavior, or cause people to relocate capital into other countries.
And right off they go. Bob McIntyre...
That is what hurts the domestic workers. Increasingly, we realize that the corporate tax, partly because of this globalization that you discussed so is sending capital abroad, and it's the U.S. workers who bear the corporate tax, not the U.S. savers.
Point taken. Our time is running down. Bob McIntyre, I want to ask you, you've got the Republican House and Senate there, American taxpayers watching. With that dynamic, what do you expect to come out of a tax overhaul at the other end? This is a proposal. It's easy to loft something right now, but it's got to make it through Congress. What do you anticipate?
Well, I think there's a constraint this time that makes this very unlikely to happen. So far in the Bush administration, they have cut the taxes primarily for the wealthy people and paid for it by borrowing the money from China. This time around, at least in the short run, the panel is saying cut taxes on capital income and raise them on wages. So that the wage earners are going to say, wait a minute, it was one thing when you borrowed it, but you're going to raise my taxes? I'm pretty much against that, and I'm not going to vote for you if you pass anything like it.
David K. Johnston, we've just got half a minute here. What do you see down the road for this pair of proposals?
Well, I don't think we're going to see either of these proposals become a law. It's unfortunate the president didn't ask for a white paper approach to taxes instead of trying to constantly fix a system that clearly is broken and is producing all sorts of perverse results.
And on the issue of where the burden falls, do you think that's going to be shifted? Are the politics out there for some kind of shift, or is it likely to stay pretty much as is?
That I don't know. I mean, in this plan, the commission asserts that within every income group, the burden would be the same. But for various individuals, there would be enormous consequences. There are some people who would get huge tax cuts out of this, and other people in the same income group who would face much higher taxes. It's very dependent on your circumstances.
Well, watch out for the details as we all get a chance to absorb them as the political process moves forward. Bob McIntyre at Citizens for Tax Justice, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Stephen Enten at the Institute for Research on the Economics of Taxation, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David K. Johnston, always good talking with you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
For a look at the new simplified tax form, see our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.